Hello everybody, welcome back. So in this session, we're going to be talking about the new features, new enhancements, which have come out in the latest release of failover clustering. Now, I want to see, by a show of hands, how many of you attended the session on high availability for virtual machines? So about a third of you, good. A lot of that content is repeated because a lot of the investments we made with this release are specifically targeted for virtual machines. So I just want to kind of set that expectation, but it looks like most of you in the room did not attend, which is great. So plenty of stuff to cover. My name is Simon Perryman. I'm a technical evangelist with Microsoft headquarters, and I spent about 4 years actually on the engineering team for failover clustering. So I built a lot of the virtualization features, management features that we're going to be discussing today. So I definitely want to go technical in this, give you kind of some insights, how clusters work, how they operate, and this will help you really understand them better so you can troubleshoot, you can keep things running, make things even more highly available. So where are we going through here? We're going to talk about, first of all, cluster design, deploying clusters, managing them, and then some of the new improvements that have come out with System Center 2012. So cluster design. High availability throughout the data center is one of our critical things. So we're going to spend a few minutes talking about our different high availability options as well. Looking at hardware, host clustering, guest clustering, storage clustering, clustering our management systems, and then finally site high availability. So let's start by talking off about hardware availability. High availability, best practices, just work with hardware vendors. You know, the key message here is redundancy everywhere. Eliminate any single point of failure. And that's going to be one of the things you need to think about when you build any type of resilient system. If there's one point where if that goes wrong, a single network, a single server, something like that, and you lose your system, you don't have a redundant system. So you want to think about building high availability throughout the stack with your servers, storage, and networking. Now, the most common type of high availability is traditional host clustering, where we have our two physical servers that are connected together. Benefits of this is that we can restart our applications, move our applications between different hosts, restart VMs, even monitor the guest operating systems of our VMs. Now, with live migration, we have mobility as well, so we can actually move those running virtual machines between different hosts, try to avoid downtime for the actual VMs, the applications. And so by doing this, you can patch your host systems without actually impacting the virtual machines. The second most common type is what we call guest clustering. And this is where we actually cluster within the virtual layer itself. So if you think about, you know, how a failover cluster is built, you have the requirements of having Windows Server. You have to run Validate, have supported hardware. And so whether it's physical hardware or virtual hardware, we actually don't care. So you can just deploy this fully virtualized cluster. Now, benefits of guest clustering are for application availability running inside the VM. So think about if you have two virtual machines and you have a SQL server that's running within them. So what happens if that SQL server crashes, the cluster detects it, it can restart that SQL server within the VM. It could fail over the SQL server between the different VMs. Another benefit is when you need to do patching or maintenance within the VM. You have less downtime if you do a failover while you're patching, instead of actually shutting down the service, patching, rebooting, bringing it back online. So it's going to give you smaller maintenance windows when you're doing servicing as well. VM storage availability is a new feature which we introduced in Windows Server 2012. With VM storage availability, we can actually make our file servers highly available. Now, we've had traditional file server clustering for a long time. It's actually one of the original types of clustering we started with. But what's kind of changed with this release is the fact that Hyper-V can now run on file shares. You've heard about Hyper-V over SMB. It's basically Hyper-V running on a file share. So SMB is the protocol that file shares use to, you know, copy files, do permissions, things like that. So now that we can have Hyper-V running on file shares as the shared storage, we can actually cluster that shared storage as well, cluster those file shares to make our virtual machine access points highly available. So the way this works is we go and we put a client access point or the share name across each of our different cluster nodes, our file server cluster nodes. So whack whack, in this example, we have scale out file server, SOFS. And this is going to live across all these different nodes. So there's two major benefits for this type of deployment, this type of topology. First of all, it helps distribute traffic across all of these different hosts. You're splitting up the incoming traffic. If you have multiple requests from a VM, or you have a single file share with multiple VMs, we could go and distribute that traffic across those different access points. Second major benefit we have is this provides resiliency as well. And what I mean by that is if one of those file shares crashes that a VM is using, let's say on server one, it will actually stop committing memory down to the file share, go reroute itself through server two, and the VM will continue to run. So basically, the VM can redirect its access across these different file shares. So this is going to give you even higher availability for your VM, because the actual connection from the VM to its shared storage is highly available using this type of cluster. So this is something that we want to encourage our customers to start using. Also, we could drive down costs, because you're using commodity hardware, just creating file shares on whatever storage you already have today. This supports storage spaces, one of the Windows Server 2012 new features. So you're going to have, you know, quite a lot of different deployment options here. Next thing we talk about is management high availability. Actually, keeping our management systems online. Now, Failover Cluster Manager itself, that runs across all the different nodes. So the failover clustering engine, that's always going to stay highly available, so long as you have Quorum in the cluster. But for the other management servers from System Center, we want to make sure that these stay running as well. So if you want to actually make your System Center servers highly available, you could do that by putting them inside a VM, putting that VM on top of a cluster, monitoring it with Operations Manager, backing it up with Data Protection Manager. So that will keep like your management console highly available. System Center 2012 also runs on SQL as its backend database. So we want to think about availability for that database so System Center itself can actually manage all these different components. If System Center doesn't have access to its database, it can't really do a whole lot. So we want to have high availability for the System Center database too. And we do that using SQL clustering. So it supports always on, traditional SQL clustering, and you could do things such as replication, run SQL inside a VM, back up the SQL database with Data Protection Manager, monitor it with Operations Manager. So you kind of have high availability for your actual management console as well as the backend database. Now, the other System Center components, some of them have their own other types of high availability that are unique to them. Now, System Center Advisor is the new System Center cloud service. That runs up in Windows Azure, so you don't even really need to think about that. Windows Azure itself is geo-replicated, redundant, always available. Several of the System Center components have web consoles, such as App Controller, Service Manager Service Portal, Orchestrator Deployment, the Orchestrator Runbook Console, the Web Service. And so all of these different websites, they can be made highly available to using network load balancing. Network load balancing distributes traffic across multiple front-end servers to avoid one of them being overloaded and to provide redundancy in case one of them is unavailable. Operations Manager and Orchestrator, they both have a very similar concept of management groups with a leader and then secondary servers. If one of the primary servers goes down, this leader, the secondary server detects it, it promotes a new server to the leader. So it kind of has, it's not quite failover, but it's kind of some redundancy with built-in logic as far as being actually able to promote the different services. Virtual Machine Manager, this can use the library server. That can be put on a clustered file share, so your files are always available. And then the VMM management server itself, this can now run directly on top of a failover cluster. So the VMM management console is highly available without having to put it inside a VM. This means if it crashes, we can detect the crash quicker, we can restart it quicker, you could fail it over between the different nodes. So a lot of high availability built through our management suite. Then finally, we think about site availability. What happens if we lose our entire data center? So since Windows Server 2003, clustering has been able to run in multiple data centers. We call this multi-site clustering. Now, what this means is if you actually lose an entire data center, the nodes in the other data center can detect it. They know what applications were running. They'll fail it over. They'll bring them online on your secondary data center. So you can be resilient to the loss of an entire data center. The key thing to think about here, though, is that your data needs to be available in both locations. If you have all of your data at your first site and that site crashes, or there's a power outage or some type of natural disaster, you still need to be able to access that data. So we need to make sure that we're replicating it between sites. Now, if you want to do work with third parties, there are lots of third-party replication solutions. All of the storage vendors have block-level replication, where they're actually replicating directly between the storage arrays. And then there's a lot of file-based replication vendors as well, which will actually copy a VHD or a file share and actually replicate that between sites. So lots of different replication options here. But we also introduced Hyper-V Replica with Windows Server 2012, which is an in-box replication solution for virtual machines. And we're going to talk a little bit more about that later. So that was just a quick introduction to kind of set the stage of these different layers of availability. Really, the key ones we're going to be thinking about are host clustering and guest clustering, so the physical servers and the virtual machines. So our next investment was working with our OEMs, our hardware partners, to make it easier to go and deploy and set up a cluster. So we've provided a framework within Failover Cluster Manager where our OEMs can basically go and plug into. They have an extensibility option that allows them to go and make it easy to quickly deploy a cluster. So this means when you plug in your power supplies, plug in your internet cables, turn on the server, you now get a boot screen from Dell or HP or Fujitsu or whoever. It will ask you a few questions such as, what are the names of the different nodes? What's the name of the cluster? What domain should it be in? Ask you for your admin password so it can join the domain. And then it will ask questions about the storage. Once you kind of filled out this form, click deploy, and it will go through an end-to-end cluster deployment up to 64 nodes. And this can be done in about 30 minutes from powering on. So kind of a nice, easy way to get up and running if you're brand new to clustering. Now, as you think about your actual purchases, as far as what version of Windows Server do I need, a couple considerations here. First, in the past, failover clustering was not in the standard edition. With Windows Server 2012, failover clustering is included in standard edition. So if you just get Windows Server, normal version, you can now use clustering. So there's really three different versions that you're going to want to evaluate for clustering. You have Microsoft Hyper-V Server, which is our free SKU. You have Standard Edition and Data Center Edition. So the kind of the main differences between these three. Well, with Hyper-V Server, since it's a free operating system, you don't have to worry about licensing. But it only runs clustering and Hyper-V. It's not going to be a Windows Server where you can have Active Directory or file servers. Windows Server Standard Edition. With this one license for the host, you get two licenses for two virtual machines running on that host. With Data Center Edition, with one license on a host, you get an unlimited number of licenses for your virtual machines. So if you're going to be highly virtualized, you want to use the Data Center Edition, then you don't have to worry about managing your VMs. Our Windows Server 2012 R2, one of the new Hyper-V features, is automatic VM activation. What this means is if your host is licensed, when you deploy the virtual machine, it will automatically license that virtual machine using the same key that you provided for your host. Every time you restart the VM, it will go take the new host license. Every 7 days, it will again check. So one of the goals here was just to make the licensing easier. Instead of having people having to set up KMS servers and enter product keys inside their virtual machines, we now have this automatic activation. As far as the other licensing goes, it's free for Microsoft Hyper-V. And then Windows Server and Standard Edition and Data Center Edition are licensed by the number of CPUs you have. So it's per two CPUs. So talking a little more about Hyper-V Server, we really want to encourage people to use this if they're doing clustering with Hyper-V. The reason why is it's going to give you higher availability. So Hyper-V Server, we give it away for free because we're trying to increase our adoption of Hyper-V. So you don't have to worry about licensing this host. And just to be very clear, this is not an evaluation edition. This is a full version. You can keep it running forever, fully supported by Microsoft. You'd never have to pay for this. If you want to run Linux inside your virtual machines, you can even have a free solution throughout the stack. But again, remember, this isn't full version of Windows Server. It's just Hyper-V, failover clustering, and then the networking and storage features that support that. But it supports all of the Hyper-V features. It supports all of the clustering features. So you can have 64-node clusters with 8,000 VMs. You can have Hyper-V replica, live migration, all fully supported with this. Now, one of the big differences that scares people is there's no graphical user interface. It's built on top of Windows Server Core. So when you actually boot it, you don't get just a command prompt. We actually give you what's called sc-config, which is this little blue box you see up here. And so it's kind of like a command prompt, but it gives you guidance on the most common tasks. So when you first boot, you can join domains, turn on Windows Update, change time zone, things like that, kind of the basic operations. Now, you can also manage this remotely. So even though there's no GUI, you can use Hyper-V Manager with the full GUI to manage it. You can use Failover Clustering Manager. You can use System Center Virtual Machine Manager. You can use Remote Server Administrator tools. So even though it doesn't come with a GUI, it has full remoting support if you want to manage it with a GUI. Now, the reason why we recommend this is because it's going to be more secure. It's going to give you fewer patches. There's no Internet Explorer. There's no GUI. There's none of these other components. Fewer patches means fewer reboots, less security vulnerabilities, which in turn is going to give you higher uptime. Now, if you don't want to use Hyper-V server and you want to go ahead and use traditional Windows Server, we definitely want to recommend installing the minimum GUI possible. So there's now four different graphical user interface options when you use Windows Server 2012 R2. There is Core, which is just basically a command prompt. There's Min Shell, which is what you see on the top, which is kind of like a command prompt, but gives you a little more guidance, gives you kind of some menus. You have full version, and then you have the full version with the desktop experience. And so that does, you know, the nice graphics and transparent panes, things like that. Stuff that we shouldn't really care about too much for visualization. So again, we want to encourage people to install Core. Go with the absolute minimum you can, fewer patches, fewer reboots. Let's talk about network planning. Clusters need a lot of networks. That's just a fact. And as you kind of look at why we need the networks, the goal here is to try to have different networks for each use. And we want to be careful to make sure that we try to isolate the networks, make sure that we don't flood them. And one of the main reasons why is we want to avoid false failovers. So internally, the way that the cluster goes and communicates with all the other nodes is they send out heartbeats, which are just basically pings. Every, I believe it's 1.2 seconds or 1 second, it sends out a ping, waits for a response. Every 5 seconds, it does a more thorough health check. It actually checks whether the cluster service is running on the other node. So we have kind of basic tests and then more thorough tests. Now, the problem that you can have is if you have a network that's flooded, let's say you're doing a live migration between two hosts, those pings aren't going to get through. If we don't have the pings getting through, one node could think the other node is down, and it could trigger a failover, even though it's actually up and running and it's healthy. So best practice in the past has always been provide single networks for each of your users, each of your types of use. So the four that we really want to think about here is access to our applications or what's running on the cluster. So this is basically going to be a public network. Now, we want to keep this isolated because we don't want our end users, which could actually be the public, you know, who are using our VMs, accessing our services. We don't want them doing anything malicious, such as flooding our networks or trying to inject lots of data. So by isolating that private network, worst thing they can do is just block out other public users. Sorry, the public network. Worst thing they can do is block out other public users. So you want to keep the public on their own network. The second one is our internal network for cluster communication. So this is where we send out our heartbeats. This is where we do some update mechanisms. This is how we go and basically communicate between our cluster nodes. Now, this could be a pretty lightweight network. This could be 100 megabytes, because we're really not using it for too much. But we really want to keep this clean so that we can make sure our heartbeats are going through. For our virtual machines, you want to have a dedicated network if you're using virtualization for live migration, for cluster shared volume, redirected traffic. This is going to be the network you want to make as big as possible. This way, we can do our live migrations faster, push data through as fast as possible. So live migration network, make that big. Now, depending on what type of storage solution you're using, if you're using an Ethernet-based storage solution, you're going to need yet another network for storage. Keep that isolated, keep that dedicated. So that would be if you're doing fiber channel over Ethernet, iSCSI, and SMB, so Hyper-V over SMB. So you use that type of storage, you're going to have a dedicated network for that. Now, different backup solutions as well, they recommend using a dedicated network for backup. So you make sure that your backups always happen. Your backups get copied. So this is kind of how we break it down, figuring out all these different networks for different uses. Now, what we've seen recently, since we've seen so many customers start to use Hyper-V virtualization, and we're starting to see 10-gig networks become more common, we're actually seeing a lot of customers be successful by just having a pair of teamed 10-gig networks. So what this means is there's enough throughput, and they manage quality of service. We'll talk a little more about quality of service later, but quality of service basically gives maximum and minimums for a particular VM or a particular application that's using our network. So long as we always reserve space in this large network for our heartbeat traffic to go through, you'll be fine using a teamed 10-gig networks. So we improved our cluster shared volume interoperability with this release as well. So cluster shared volumes is our distributed access file system. Now, in our past release, it's only supported Hyper-V. But with Windows Server 2012, we added support for file shares, for file servers. And that scale-out file server that we showed earlier that has whack-whack my share, whack-whack my share spread across these different hosts, that's actually using cluster shared volumes. It's basically allowing people to access a single disk simultaneously from different locations. So we've used that same technology. But we did make a lot of improvements with CSV in this release. In fact, we rewrote the entire driver. And the reason why was we had a lot of interoperability problems with the first version of cluster shared volumes. And the reason for that is the actual cluster shared volumes filter, the thing which communicates between CSV on two different hosts, that sits within the file system stack. Now, if you pass traffic from one host to another host through this file system stack, it's possible that we actually skip part of the stack on one host. And so if you have backup vendors or antivirus vendors, depending on where they sit in relation to the CSV filter, we were sometimes bypassing those entirely. So your disks weren't getting backed up. You weren't having anti-malware, you weren't having system scans. So the reason why we completely rewrote it, compatibility, making sure that it's going to work with all types of drivers, and it doesn't skip anything going through the file system filter. Now, we added support on cluster shared volumes of the new file system, which came out in Windows Server 2012, called REFS, Resilient File System. Basically, REFS gives you the ability to, it's kind of like a built-in, highly available file system itself. So you traditionally have a FAT, NTFS. This is the new one, REFS. And so it's going to automatically do things that disks naturally do, such as journal scrubbing. It has parity bits built in. So basically, this file system itself has error check-in built into the system, not done on the drive level, but done within the actual operating system. So definitely something that you want to consider moving to REFS. Now, since REFS is pretty new, it came out in 2012, updated in 2012 R2, not all applications support REFS. So you want to be cautious as far as using REFS as an all-purpose file system currently, as we're still kind of working through some interoperability with some other systems. But if you can use it, definitely want to use it. Give you more resiliency, avoid things such as disk corruption. Another enhancement that we added with cluster shared volumes was the CSV cache. So what we kind of realized with cluster shared volumes, like any computer system, is caching can be useful. You often see the same type of data again and again and again. You know, you see 20% of the data 80% of the time is kind of how they talk about that ratio there. And so we built a cache directly into each of the hosts so that you can do CSV caching. And typical traffic that goes through your file system through CSV, you can allocate a cache on the host, and we'll store it there so you have less I/O going back and forth from your disks. We added support for storage tiering. So storage tiering is one of the new features in Windows Server 2012 R2, allowing you to take commodity hardware, JBOD disks, have your fast-spinning SSDs as tier one, your normal rotating disks as tier two, slower drives as tier three, and have us automatically go and manage the storage, move things between these as they're needed. So tiered spaces, this also works with cluster shared volumes. Parity spaces works with cluster shared volumes. Deduplication works with cluster shared volumes. And all of the different system center components support cluster shared volumes, including data protection manager, could do live migration on cluster shared volume disks. Operations manager can monitor them. Orchestrator can automate access to them through VMM. And our virtual machine manager can see them, understand them, deploy VMs to them. So we also added support around virtualization for a new type of disk for our guest clusters. And this is the shared VHDX disk. Now, the reason why we want to use this is for our hosters or for people that have a lot of users, where they give them VMs and allow them to set up their own guest clusters. When you have a guest cluster, you still need to have shared storage, just like a regular cluster. Now, within the virtual world, there are some limitations just based on what Hyper-V can and cannot do. The biggest one that we got past this year was being able to support Fibre Channel. So with Hyper-V Windows Server 2012, we added a virtualized host bus adapter, HBA, for Hyper-V. This way, your VMs can go and access the Fibre Channel storage. You can also use SMB file shares, iSCSI, or Fibre Channel over Ethernet, any of these Ethernet-based protocols. But what we had this problem was with these people who were now deploying these guest clusters, they were giving their end users a couple of VMs, but then they would also have to give them real storage, actually give them a LAN. And a lot of hosters didn't want to expose that storage ecosystem to their end users. So what we can do with this release is use a VHDX file, the file that a VM is made out of, connect that to two different guest cluster nodes at once, and have them use that as shared storage. This way, we're presenting a file to our end users rather than the actual LAN. And so basically, what they would do is they have their two virtual machines. Let's say SQL is running within the VM. The SQL's data is going to be stored on that shared VHDX. So they're basically using that as a new type of shared storage. We added a lot of improvements around cluster validation. Cluster validation makes sure that our clusters are supported, makes sure that it's going to function correctly. And so first of all, big improvement was around storage validation, making it faster. We actually, in the past, used to validate clusters by testing every single LAN against every single cluster node. And so if you had 500 disks and a 64-node cluster, it actually took several days to validate. And we had a customer, a large social network, that had that exact problem. It took them days to validate their cluster. So we want to make this better. We now have algorithms where we don't have to test every single disk against every node. We could do quick tests, and so we make our storage tests several times faster. If you're testing an existing cluster, running validation against it, you can pick a particular LAN to test now. So you don't have to do all of the disks or none of the disks. You can pick just a single disk you want to test. Now, also, since we have storage live migration, if you want to go and test a disk and you have a VM cluster, a Hyper-V cluster, you can storage live migrate that VM out of the cluster, do maintenance to the disk, do validation to the disk, bring it online, bring it offline, make sure it's working, take it out to maintenance, and then storage live migrate that VHD back. So this way, you could kind of do maintenance, do testing on your VM clusters, zero downtime to the actual VMs. We also supported replicated storage with this release. So if you have a multi-site cluster with storage in one location replicated to the other location, we can actually test that and make sure it's compatible. In our previous release, we would just throw a warning and say, we don't understand the storage. Please make sure that you work with your replication vendor to ensure it's supported. Now we are actually testing them. And then we added network reliability tests. So I mentioned earlier that one of our heartbeat mechanisms was sending these pings back and forth. We found that some customers had firewalls that prevented us from actually communicating with the port we needed. 3389. And so we're just making sure that port's open so we can do these health checks. And within Hyper-V, we continue to enhance this. making more tests, making them more detailed. And we'll actually go over to our cluster now and take a look at these in more detail. So I'm going to log on to my Windows Server 2012 R2 cluster. This is in preview edition still. And here's our new validation report. Well, I won't say new. It kind of looks and acts the same as before. But under Hyper-V configuration, we continue to pre-test before people get their Hyper-V servers up and running. Let me zoom in a little bit. Okay, maybe that's too much. Zoom out a little bit. So first thing we got to do is actually list information about the servers running Hyper-V. And so this is where we're going to make sure that the Hyper-V role is installed. And then we're going to take a look at the hardware across each of those hosts and see whether they support VMQ, whether they support SRIOV. And these are network card optimizations that you actually buy with a physical network card to make things faster when they're working with virtual machines. Next test that we look at here is compatibility of our virtual fiber channel SANs. So if you've gone ahead and created you're building a guest cluster, a cluster made of VMs, you're connecting with fiber channel, we make sure that that's compatible as well, that you have the correct port names, the correct settings, so that they're consistent across all of your guest cluster nodes. Next couple things that we check are checking that our memory is compatible, checking that our networks are compatible. So one problem that our customers often ran into was they would have different virtual switch names across their different hosts. And so when the VM was on host one and it was using switch one, then it failed over to host two, it would still be trying to use switch one. And so we needed to make sure that we have the same consistent name for all of our virtual switches across all of our different nodes. So we're testing that up front here too. We check that the Hyper-V role is installed, check that our storage is compatible, and then finally, we check that we have matching processors. The reason why this is important for virtualization is there's a requirement to have all of your hosts running Intel or all of your hosts running AMD. You can't mix and match. The reason for this is when we try to do a live migration and we're copying memory from one host to another, we need to have those processors compatible so we know how to copy the memory. Now, you can have different versions within the same family. That is supported. The way that works is basically the node with the higher version will drop down to a lower level, so it will become slower. It will use the older version. But it's supported to have different stepping versions so long as they're the same processor family. Now, we wanted to make it a little easier to do our upgrades as well, to move between different versions of Hyper-V. So between Windows Server 2012 to 2012 R2, you can live migrate your VMs. This means that you're not actually, while you update your physical infrastructure, you don't have to impact those virtual machines that are running on top of them. Now, at some point, you also need to upgrade your integration components that run within the VM. The integration components basically allow us to go and communicate with the VM host, things such as starting it, stopping it, taking checkpoints, things like that. So you don't need to do this immediately. In fact, the 2012 integration components will work on a 2012 R2 host. You just don't get the advantage of the new Hyper-V features until they are upgraded, such as our enhanced session mode, being able to do file copy and paste between our host and our console, things like that. So we recommend wait until your next reboot of that virtual machine and then install the integration components then. So we also improved our migration wizard, which we now call the copy cluster roles wizard. And this allows you to move cluster workloads from previous clusters to a single cluster, or allows you to consolidate from multiple clusters to a single cluster. So let's say you have VMs that are running on 2008 R2. We don't support live migration from them, but you can use this migration tool. And it's basically going to go and copy the virtual machine's configuration file, copy its hardware configuration, so the number of virtual networks, things like that. And then it's going to offer you the ability to remap your old virtual networks to new virtual networks in case they're named differently on the host. Now, what it does not do, though, it does not actually copy data from the disk. So if you have two clusters, two storage arrays, and you actually want to upgrade the storage as well, at some point you need to do a manual copy of that data. But we find most customers don't simultaneously upgrade both their storage and their clusters at the same time. Usually they're going to keep using the same storage. Now here's the other roles which are supported on top of a cluster. But we see over 95% of all clusters using Hyper-V, SQL, Exchange, and File Server. And so you'll notice throughout what we've been working on with this release and the past release, we're really focusing on these workloads, making them better integrated, easier to manage, using a single centralized location. We support many other Windows Server roles as well, DHCP, iSCSI, iSCSI targets, etc. We also have what we call generic containers. And a generic container we've actually had for a few releases. It allows you to basically make different types of applications that aren't built in highly available. So for our generic applications, you can make any .exe executable file highly available. You store that executable file's data on the shared disk. If that executable crashes, it will restart. You can fail over the executable between the different nodes, so long as we keep that same concept of the shared data, the shared disk. We can do the same thing with scripts. So if you have like a PowerShell script or a VB script you want to keep highly available, that can also fail over between the nodes. Same thing with any type of service. Any service that we see within Service Control Manager, that list of services, you can put on a cluster. So keep it highly available, always restarting. Now we also have a full extensibility model as well, where we allow people to write what we call their own resource DLL. And this basically makes their custom application are fully functional on a cluster. And so you could kind of think of a resource DLL as a mapping of operations from what the cluster wants to do to what that application needs to do. So for example, in cluster terminology, we say start the role, turn it on. For that particular application, that could be something like netsh start.exe. We don't know. But you could basically form the mapping. So what does it mean to online the resource, to check its health, to see whether it's failed, to look at different event logs? So we have some documentation available online. So if you have a line of business application you want to fully integrate with clustering, that ability is available as well. All right, so that kind of gave the overview of our cluster deployment. Let's take a look at managing clusters next. Now, with this release, one thing that's extremely important that we're really trying to emphasize is that Hyper-V clusters are different. In the past, we've tried to just kind of use a generic theory that all clusters are the same, they should all function the same. But we're really realizing with this high amount of virtualization that Hyper-V clusters, we really do need to treat differently. So you notice that we've had the new cluster validation tests pre and post deployment. We talked about our shared VHDX file for our guest clusters. Now, next thing that we do for Hyper-V clusters is we reconfigure our heartbeat settings. So again, the heartbeats are the health checks that we send out. Now, traditionally, heartbeats are set for every 5 seconds if you're on the same subnet or you're going to different subnets. But this is adjustable, so if you're doing like a multi-site cluster, you might want to put that up to 20 seconds, 60 seconds, something like that. And so what we realize, though, with virtualization, when there's all these live migrations happening, even though we often recommend having distinct networks for each of our hosts, many customers still don't follow that, and they still have, you know, a few networks. They get flooded, live migration traffic, CSV traffic, heartbeats don't get through. So as soon as you go and deploy the first virtual machine on your cluster in 2012 R2, we go and automatically reconfigure the heartbeat settings. Made them a little longer, so you're less likely to get a false failover. The second major change we make is to our cluster database. Now, I'm going to go a little technical here and explain kind of what the cluster database is and why it's relevant. So cluster database is part of the actual registry. So if you go into your registry under hklm/cluster, you'll see a list of entries. And basically, in the database, we have an entry, a registry key, for everything that happens in the cluster. So every workload, every property, and then the state of those different workloads. So you might have a file server, it has a name, it has different shares, and its current state is online. Now, what's really important for us is we always want to make sure that every node in the cluster has a consistent view, an identical view, of this database. And the reason why is if we have a partition where some of the nodes over here can't speak to nodes over here. We want them to know exactly what the cluster looked like before they had that partition, so they have a shared, single, consistent view of the cluster. The thing that we don't want to have happen is they have different views of the cluster. Things change on one side, things change on a different side, and then there's some challenges when they try to sync back together again because they have inconsistent views of what's happening. So what we do with the cluster database is every time a change happens on the cluster, we send out an update to every other node in the cluster. This is done using the Global Update Manager, or GUM. Now, what we have to do then is, before that change gets committed on the first node, is wait for responses from every other node in the cluster. So let's say I'm deploying a new virtual machine. I click deploy. Internally, we change the state from off to starting. What we're then going to do is send an update to every node in the cluster, saying state is changing to starting, and then wait for a response back. Once we get the response back, we commit it, and then we will actually let it start. So it's kind of like a pre-check. We want to make sure that every node sees this before the action takes place. Now, what we found is with these larger and larger clusters, 64 nodes, it was taking longer to get acknowledgement back from 63 other nodes. That was causing delays in the time to deploy VMs, to start services, to do failover, things like that, core functionality. So with this release, we've gone and updated this internal mechanism, and now we only require responses back from more than half, a majority. This way, if we have a partition, no matter where the partition is, so long as more than half of the nodes in the cluster know the state, we should be able to make sure that we have a consistent view, or if not, when we merge, more nodes will have the correct view. And so you kind of do like there's like an internal voting system. If more nodes have one of these view than the other nodes, that's the side that wins, that's the state that wins. So by forcing a majority, more than half of the nodes, to always have this state, even if there's a partition, we can still, when we merge, figure out which partition should win, which version of the database we want to have authoritative. So the change we did in this release just dropped it down to half. We only need more than half the responses. All right, so some other changes to management now. We made some improvements to the failover cluster manager, the actual graphical user interface. So it's easier to see multiple clusters at once. You get more information about the state of your nodes and about your disks. But let's actually go to our demo and kind of walk through this rather than talk about it. So here's my cluster that we have up here. And once this loads, we're going to notice that the display has changed slightly. We include more kind of default action items for people to do. So making it easier to migrate, get help links, view events, things like that. So here you can see we have these additional configuration options. Here's our links to go and navigate the different pieces. And then under our core cluster resources, we provide information about like the quorum disk, which is basically our voting disk in the cluster. Under roles, I don't believe I have any roles deployed on this cluster, but we now support multi-select. So if you wanted to start up 100 VMs at once, you'd be able to do that. Here's an example with our nodes. Sorry, slight hang here. So you could do multi-select, do actions across all these different nodes. Now you'll also notice we have this key here called assign vote and current vote. And we've changed our quorum model significantly in 2012 R2. We're going to spend quite a bit of time talking about quorum next. But this is where you can kind of get an immediate view of how our different agents are voting. Under storage, we have our disks like usual. Could do multi-select. Converting them to CSV is the same method as before. Just click the button, convert to cluster shared volumes. Networking information is pretty similar on this page here. You have direct links to configure live migration settings. So you could go more easily pick which networks should be used for live migration. In our previous release, we had to go through this kind of painful PowerShell process called network prioritization, where we had to rank our different networks based on these arbitrary numbers, 1 to 10,000 or 10,000 and above. Try to make it a lot easier, actually expose this through the graphical user interface. So this is kind of some of the key failover cluster management improvements we made. OK, on to quorum. So first of all, I want to just kind of give a brief definition of what traditional quorum is, why it's important, so that everybody kind of is on the same page here. So quorum is what we use to decide cluster membership. And what I mean by that is, if we have a partition between some of the nodes where they can't speak to other nodes, we only want one of those groups of nodes to be running. So let's say I have a three-node cluster, and I have a partition. The side with two nodes, the side with the majority, quorum, is going to stay online, it's going to keep acting, it's going to start VMs, stop services, access the disks. The side that does not have majority, it's going to sit there and wait. It's not going to start anything. It's going to keep trying to rejoin the main cluster. Now, the reason why we don't let this guy start anything is because we don't want simultaneous things happening in two versions of the cluster, which can cause things to go out of sync in our internal database. This side just sits patiently. When he rejoins the cluster, he gets the most recent version of the cluster database. Everybody has a consistent view again, and it can start functioning in a cluster. So this is kind of the key concepts of quorum. Now, in our previous releases, we've had several different quorum options. Node majority, node and disk majority, node and file share majority. You can still use those if you want. We haven't replaced them, but we have a much more intelligent algorithm now that is on by default, and we're encouraging people to use. And this is based on nodes dynamically voting. So actually, first of all, one other thing I should add here. By default, you can actually say whether a node has a vote or not. So you might have a primary site with like three servers, a secondary site with two servers. You may want the secondary site not to really have any vote so that it doesn't affect quorum up here. So you can just say, now, this node has a vote, this node does not have a vote. And that's a fixed setting. What we're now doing, though, with our dynamic quorum is we're going to automatically assign a quorum disk to you, whether you want one or not. Now, the quorum disk is basically a third vote or an additional vote that you can use to kind of arbitrate. And so let's say I only have a two-node cluster. Well, if I have a partition, which side wins? They're equal, right? So what we do is we provide this disk with a vote. It's the traditional cluster disk, which means only one node can access it at a time. And so whichever of these two nodes has access to the disk, has an open handle on the disk, that node gets an extra vote. So if it's this one on this partition has access to the quorum disk, this side stays online. This side will wait. It will wait until it can join. So we kind of use this disk as this extra voter when the nodes can't communicate over the network. So what we've done in 2012R2 is we're always going to assign you this disk. And as you have nodes coming up, starting, stopping, we're going to go and adjust that vote on that disk. Some cases, that disk will have zero votes. Doesn't matter. So let's say I have five running servers. We always want an odd number of votes as well. I should add that. That way, whenever we have a partition, there'll always be a majority on one side. So key requirement, odd number of votes. So what we're now doing with this quorum disk is we're going to turn it on or off based on whether there's an even number of nodes in the cluster or an odd number of nodes in the cluster. So let's say I start with a five-node cluster. My disk has zero votes because I always have an odd number. Now, I take one of my nodes down for maintenance. I only have a four-node cluster. We then turn the disk on as the fifth vote. I take down another node, down to three, turn off the disk, add it back, turn it back on. So we're basically dynamically adjusting this vote on the disk as the nodes come in and out of usage. And we really decided to do this because we're just seeing larger and larger clusters, these 32-node, 64-node clusters. So we want people to not really have to think about quorum as much anymore. Like if you had a 64-node cluster and only 32 of those servers were running, we would actually shut it down in our old model. It did not have majority. Even though you have 32 healthy servers, we would turn them off, not have quorum. So we're going to constantly adjust the quorum votes, make sure that you're always going to have enough servers to run. Now, that was kind of a bit of a tricky topic. Does anybody have any questions around the new quorum model here? Well, let's go over to a demo and kind of take a look at it in action here. Yes? Will the vote turn on if a cluster node is being evicted? What would happen there? Let me just think this one through. So what would happen there is you would evict the cluster node. We would then blast out an update to all the other nodes saying this node is no longer in membership. Once we got the response back, that would be committed, and then we would go and adjust the disk. So yes, including node eviction, that disk adjustment will be included. Same with add node. If you add a new node to the cluster, we're going to dynamically adjust that as well. All right, so let's actually take a look at this in action here. Okay, so I'm going to take a look at my nodes here. And currently I have a 4-node cluster. So that means that my disk is going to be on, right? I'm going to have that extra vote, so I always have 5. If we go take a look at our settings up here, we should see the witness disk is on. We'll go down. We see I have my witness disk here. Okay, so let's go back to our nodes again. You know what? Let's actually do what you just asked. Let's go and evict a node from the cluster and see the behavior here. So we're going to go click on this node, more actions, evict the node. Now, in theory, what should happen? Again, haven't done this myself. In theory, what should happen here? We take this node out of the cluster. We then drop down to 3 voting nodes. We're going to go and turn that disk off. So we're down to 3 nodes. All of them are voting. Go to our disk here. You see that we still have our disk, and it looks like it is still voting. Let me just go double check on the actual Quorum model here. So I go more actions, configure my cluster settings. This is the new updated Quorum wizard as well. We try to make it a little more complete. Using the default Quorum settings. So I go back. Let me do the advanced one so we can see the details here. So here's where we have the ability to go and say which nodes vote, which nodes don't vote. So we'll take this one out. You can say no nodes need to vote as well if you want. Turn off all of your votes. Configure the disk. Click finish, go back to my nodes here. And we can see that we've turned on the disk, we've turned off a node. So to answer the question, I can't actually tell whether evicting it turned that disk on or off. I think there's a PowerShell commandlet to see whether the disk is currently voting or not. But here you can see that we turned off one of the nodes, currently has 0 votes in it. So let's go and, let's see. So right now we have only 2 votes in a 3-node cluster. Let's go and, sorry, let me go turn this back on, and then I'm going to stop the cluster service, and we'll see that these votes change again. So I'm going to go back to my Quorum settings. Turn this one back on so it's voting. Use the same disk as before. Click finish. Go back to my nodes. And so what we see now is I have 3 nodes in the cluster, 2 are voting, and I have my disk as well. So this is where we could kind of go and adjust, go and toggle all of these different votes through our Quorum settings. Okay, a couple more improvements that we made to Quorum now to help deal with split brain in multi-site clusters. So we kind of talked about this problem a little earlier. I'm going to go into some more detail about when you have 2 versions of the cluster kind of getting out of sync. So we call this concept or this problem what's known as a split brain in the industry. So let's say, you know, I have 2 nodes that are running. There's a partition. They don't speak to each other. One of them's running the application. The other's waiting patiently. It makes changes. Then that guy crashes or goes off. Then this guy comes on. He's still allowed because he's the only voter. He makes changes. He goes offline. Well, the problem that we have here is both of them were running legally because they were both in majority at their respective times, but they've both done different things in the cluster, and they have different views of this cluster database. So this is where they're out of sync, and this is what's known as the split brain problem, where you don't really know who's supposed to win here. So the way we have resolved this in the past is we have this concept of forcing quorum. Forcing quorum will basically mean one of the sides is going to come online. And what we now do is if you force quorum on a particular site, the site that you force quorum on will be the authoritative site. So let's say I have my two, one that are coming up, one that are coming down. If I say this is the one that should come online, this is the side that's going to win. When this guy rejoins, the database syncs that way. So you basically built in a way to go and sync that database. Okay, so same option or slightly different thing here is a how to function if you have a partition and there's an equal number of votes in the cluster. So let's say you have a multi-site cluster, four nodes at site A, four nodes at site B. Well, who has majority if there's a partition? Both of them have four votes. We now have a private property that you can configure, and whichever node has that private property turned on, that's the side that's going to lose. Now, it sounds kind of a slightly odd implementation, but basically what you do, you have this property, lowest quorum priority node ID, and the node which has that property turned on, that's the side that's always going to lose. So you have this partition, you can basically always say, if I have four and four, this is my primary site, this is my secondary site, because my secondary site has this lowest node ID. All right, back to some more graphical user interface, less internals here. So next enhancement we made was protecting against accidental shutdown of a VM. We found that with these large systems that are running hundreds of VMs, we have multiple administrators using them at the same time. Sometimes they're not all virtualization admins. Now, the challenge that we saw with some customers is they would have one admin shutting down the computer or applying a patch, and it would turn off the VMs. So what we now have done is directly into the shutdown controls, we've built cluster awareness, we've built VM awareness. So if you have any VMs that are running on that host when you do shutdown, it's going to wait, it's going to live migrate them off the host based on priority of the VM, and then once they're off, it will shut down. Now there's actually a timer, I believe it's 5 minutes by default, but you can adjust that. That's the wait timer for how long it's going to give to live migrate VMs. And again, it does it based on priority. If you have lots of VMs on a host, you might want to turn that up to 15 minutes, 30 minutes, based on your live migration time, just to be safe. Make sure everything gets off that host. So we also improved our Hyper-V replica. So our Hyper-V replica is our way to do asynchronous replication of virtual machines. This means in our 2012 RTM edition, every 5 minutes, we would copy the changes that happen to a VM. Basically, we would take a look at what's changing in the VHD or VHDX file, copy those changes across. So biggest piece of feedback we had is that 5 minute setting was not configurable. It still isn't, but we've given you other options now. You can now do replication every 30 seconds if you need it more frequently, want to prevent against more data loss. Or you could do replication every 15 minutes if you want it less frequently. So you want less network traffic or internet's expensive where you live. So basically built in some different types of replication frequencies. Now we also added chained replication. So you can replicate from a primary site to a secondary site, and then from the secondary site to the third site. And this request came because we had customers that were doing their replication in a metro area inside a city. And so they'd replicate, you know, from the data center in one office to the data center in the other. But they still had the problem that if the whole city lost power, they would still lose both sites. So we've added this third level of replication. So you can do near replication and then do a secondary replication to another disaster recovery location. So even more resiliency for your virtual machines. Now, the only kind of odd thing, odd behavior, or unusual thing with this is the third replication cannot be more frequent than the first replication. So you could do 30-second replications for the first two, and then either a 5-minute or a 15-minute replication for that third one. If you do 5 minutes between the first two, then you can either do 5 minutes or 15 minutes for this next one. So you can't make the third replication faster. It can be as fast. So some other cluster enhancements that we've added in this release that don't quite have their own slide. First of all is we do some more proactive monitoring before we do a failover or a live migration. So today in the previous versions, we actually don't necessarily check that the server services are running or that the virtual machine services are running as we do the live migration. Now, as part of our pre-migration checks, we're actually making sure that all of the services we need on the destination host are online, they're running. The next thing that we do proactively is before we go and live migrate or move a VM to a different host, we make sure that all the physical and virtual networks on that other host that the VM is going to need are online and functioning. So we don't want to go and move a VM to a host where there's a problem with its virtual networks or its virtual switches. The next enhancement we made was with our cluster shared volumes, trying to do some load balancing for those. Now, the way cluster shared volumes works is for each CSV disk, each cluster shared volume disk, we have what we call a coordinator. And the coordinator is essentially the brain that keeps track of who should write at which time so that we don't have synchronous access, want to make sure we avoid disk corruption. This coordinator, it's highly available. It's like a regular cluster property. It will fail over between the different nodes. But what we found over time is if you had, let's say, 10 CSV disks, you had 10 coordinators. As you were patching nodes, you would start one up, shut it down, the CSV would fail. Do the next node, the CSV would move, the CSV would move. And so over time, we found pretty uneven distribution of these coordinators. You'd see one or two nodes that had all of the coordinators running on them. So that was inefficient because that meant they were doing more processing, there was more network traffic going through those nodes. So we now have a basic algorithm that's going to purposely try to distribute those CSV coordinators across all of your different hosts, try to get some better built-in load balancing. There's storage quality of service added in this release, QoS. This allows you to provide maximum and minimum amounts of bandwidth for your storage access. This way, if you have a VM that's particularly uses a lot of storage, it's not going to go and starve those other VMs on the same host. You can assign a maximum amount of storage it can use. And so that's fully compatible with clustering, cluster shared volumes, everything like that. Then finally, we added some improvements to our logging. Get better insight, get better information, make it easier to diagnose. So one thing that we did not do a good job at in previous releases with logging was detailing all the state changes that are happening for an application or a service, coming offline, joining, online pending, things like that. We now added a lot more detail so that if you're troubleshooting, you can more precisely figure out where an error was or where a problem was. All right, and now some enhancements that we've made with System Center 2012 R2. So first of all, with Virtual Machine Manager. System Center 2012 R2 Virtual Machine Manager, it now allows you to deploy clustered file servers. So we talked about having this scale-out file server for Hyper-V. Virtual Machine Manager allows you to deploy that now. So you just have two or three hosts. You can select which hosts are going to be a clustered file server using scale-out file server. Specify the name of the server, click deploy, and it will go create that clustered file server for you and validate it. We've also supported update management for that clustered file server as well. So Virtual Machine Manager has basically a way to go and patch the different hosts. It's called update management, kind of similar to cluster-aware updating for Windows Server. And this now also supports these clustered file servers. So you can actually patch all of your fabric, all of your infrastructure servers that VMM supports. VMM in this release also added this component called a NVGRE gateway. Basically, this supports network virtualization. It allows private networks to go and communicate with corporate networks. One thing that we wanted to make sure that we supported was clustering. So if you have a failover, and you move between different networks or IP addresses change, we make sure that we update that gateway as well. So the gateway has the updated addresses and it's always going to reroute traffic to the correct host or the correct VM. Now for the rest of our other System Center integration, with App Controller, this gives you the ability to deploy VMs to clusters. And this actually can include ESX clusters, Citrix clusters, as well as Hyper-V clusters. So App Controller, through VMM, supports all the latest and greatest clustering technologies. Configuration Manager gives us the ability to patch and secure our clusters. and our VMs, making sure they stay compliant. Data Protection Manager. Big enhancement here is making sure that it can support cluster shared volumes, the latest version, so we can now backup and restore VMs on CSV disks. It also supports now backup during live migration. So you can actually have a VM that's being live migrated and backed up at the same time with no data loss. So you don't really have to worry about whether my VMs are moving during your backup schedule. Endpoint Protection, which is a subcomponent of Configuration Manager. This protects your clusters and your VMs from antivirus malware. Operations Manager has a management pack just updated for clustering. It has management packs for Hyper-V. It has management packs for VMM. So this gives you monitoring of your VMs, of your clusters, making sure they stay healthy. Orchestrator gives you the ability to automate, to create workflows, a series of schedule actions. And it works with clustering through Virtual Machine Manager. So basically, Orchestrator tells Virtual Machine Manager, deploy something to a cluster, VMM will go handle that. And so just to be clear, there's no integration pack directly for clustering. It's for VMM, and so it kind of uses VMM as an intermediary. Service Manager gives you the ability to report on clusters, do chargeback, do pricing, figure out how expensive VMs are. System Center Advisor gives you the ability to analyze your clusters and your virtual machines for best practice. I encourage you, if you didn't see the keynote, to go check out the Advisor demo there. It's going to give you proactive monitoring. And so kind of the difference between Advisor and Operations Manager is Advisor does proactive monitoring. So it's going to look for problems before they happen. And Operations Manager does real-time monitoring. It alerts you when something goes wrong, an incident. So System Center Advisor was actually a really interesting technology because it was built by our product support teams. Not actually built by them, but it was designed by them. And the reason why is they keep getting the same bugs and the same requests and the same problems again and again and again. And so they said, wouldn't it be good if we could have a tool that was a best practice analyzer that we could constantly update that includes all of these common problems our customers see? It's going to free up our time and it's going to save our customers a lot of money and downtime and avoid these problems. So really, everybody wins from that. Everybody saves money, systems stay online for longer. So basically, product support went through and they figured out all of the problems that came up that could be programmatically determined. And what I mean by that is either this setting is enabled or it's not enabled. So kind of like a binary decision. And so things that are such as whether roles should not be co-located. If you have a domain controller and Hyper-V on the same host, it's going to flag that as a warning. It's going to tell you about missing hotfixes. It's going to tell you about services that should be turned on. So it's basically trying to give you proactive monitoring. Now, this actually runs up in Windows Azure. So basically, you sign up for the free service, systemcenteradvisor.com. You go download a certificate. You connect it to your upload server, your gateway server. You then deploy agents across your other servers you want to monitor. And it actually uses the Operations Manager agent. So if you already have Operations Manager deployed, you don't need to deploy anything else. And then every day, it's going to go scan the registry, figure out what roles you have, collect this information, send it to the gateway. The gateway collects it across all of the servers, sends it up into Azure, and Windows Azure actually does all of the processing. So there's no actual processing or consumption that's taking place in your own data center. The reason why we do it up in Azure is so that we can regularly update it. As we see new patches, new best practices, this gives us the ability to make sure that it stays current, so we're proactively avoiding problems. Now, I actually used it in my own lab. I have just 6 servers, but we run hands-on labs for a lot of customer events. Have about 700 VMs running at any day. But across these 6 servers, I had 125 misconfigurations. That's a lot. That's over 20 misconfigurations on each server that I ran. So a really useful utility and definitely something I encourage you to check out. So it'll make you guys look really smart when you can, you know, go tell everybody else, hey, look at all these problems I found. You don't need to tell them it was Advisor. So that's kind of a summary of all of these changes that we've made in this release to give you even higher availability. I want to highlight one resource, the Microsoft Virtual Academy, www.microsoftvirtualacademy.com. It is our free online training portal So it gives you lots of free classes, and we have full-day training entirely dedicated to high availability, virtual machine manager, all of these other different system center components. So if you haven't been there before, a great way to get some free training from some of our technical experts. That's the short link, aka.ms/mva. And this is why you should not browse the internet on a server. Okay. So go look at the courses here, and we have several hundred courses. So covering SQL, Office, SharePoint, System Center, Windows, Windows Server. So hopefully this is a nice resource that we really want our customers to check out. All right, well with that, I want to thank you for attending. Oh, it looks like I forgot the little slide I need to add, which includes the eval. So let me just quickly throw that on the screen here. There you go. If you would like to complete an eval, send us your feedback. It'll be really helpful. We definitely want to encourage good feedback as well, so all fives are preferred. Thank you, everyone, for attending. Appreciate your time, and I hope you learned a lot about high availability here. Thank you. I'll stay around to take questions as well. We have about 2 minutes left, but I'll stay around as long as people want to talk about clustering, virtual machine, system center, high availability, anything you want. Thank you, and enjoy the rest of your time here.